And let me repeat the question and make sure I got the facts right. So we've got a tax-exempt entity that's doing advertising for a for-profit affiliate, and basically how is that pricing determined?
Yeah,
really, it depends. It depends on the relationship and how they decide to price it. Now, transfer pricing principles would dictate whether there should be a markup on that and how the markup should be calculated. And I'm not too familiar with how the transfer pricing rules. Do you know, Joyce, offhand, whether that would require a markup or it'd be kind of under a services cost exception or something?
So, the transfer pricing regulations, what they say is if the service being provided is essential to the success of the business, then there has to be a markup. And if it's not essential, then it can be done at cost. And so that's how the analysis would be done. And just an overall concept in transfer pricing is it's what a willing buyer and willing seller would exchange those products or services for if it were all done at arm's length.
All right, let's move on to alternative investments. How familiar are we in this room with alternative investments, K-1 review? Yeah. So we're all pretty familiar here. And for those of you who aren't, we'll just kind of start from the beginning. An alternative investment is really your non-traditional asset classes. So they're not traded on an exchange. These are your hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, real estate partnerships, trusts, and then certain commodities. And a lot of these are structured as a partnership. To the extent that they're structured as a corporation, the income we're getting from these would be dividends, which are excluded from UBI. And then ultimately, when we sold them, we would have capital gain, which is also excluded from UBI. But for these partnerships, the activity of the partnership is attributable to the exempt organization investor. And so we might be indirectly engaging in an unrelated trader business or generating revenue that's treated as an unrelated trader business. So we've got three ways that a fund organized as a pass-through might generate UBI. The first is if the fund is operating a trader business. The example here is a timber partnership. I've never actually seen a timber partnership, but I don't work in Canada that much or the Northwest, but I mean oil and gas partnerships are really common. We're in Texas, so I think that's a better example for this location. Borrowing to make investments. This goes back to our acquisition indebtedness. It's one of the most common areas we see UBI come through on these, especially hedge funds. They're highly leveraged investment vehicles. And this leverage can come at two different levels. The tax-exempt organization, this is the less common, can borrow money to make an investment, generally not within the investment parameters of exempt organizations. So we don't see that too often. But the more common example is where the partnership itself, the hedge fund, your private equity firm, borrows money to make their investments. Or lower tier. I mean, sometimes you see where the exempt organization is invested in one partnership, which is invested in another and another, and it goes down many tiers. And at some point along there, there's some leverage that results in acquisition indebtedness and in UBI that flows up to the tax-exempt investor. I think that's the third bullet point there. Yeah. Now, partnerships are required to give us the information that's required to determine what our UBI is. But for those of you who raise your hand and you've very well seasoned at reviewing K-1s, it's not always clear cut. It's extremely difficult, and you can get K-1s that are 200 pages, and you pour through it. You spend hours and hours, and at the end of the day, you get the best approach, and you're still not confident that you have the right number. But it is a requirement, and to the extent there's ambiguity, we often follow up with the funds directly if our clients give us permission to kind of parse out and get a more accurate number for what that is. The people who are preparing these K-1s might not be specialists in UBI from the beginning, right? So not always the most accurate information, but it's always worth the exercise to follow up and get more details when you have a K-1 that's ambiguous.
I'll just add some other color commentary here, and that is, you know, fewer than 1% of all partnerships have ever been audited in the past. And I think the IRS has estimated that their new rule with regard to the new partnership audit regulations, I don't know if y'all are familiar with that, but there is a rule that came into place a couple of years ago, and the IRS can now assess tax on a partnership. And the reason why so many of these partnerships were never audited is because there's a body of law called the TEFRA rules that requires that the IRS send notification to all the partners in a partnership and let those partners deal with certain issues that arose during the exam directly with the IRS and not work with the partnership. Who is at that time the tax matters partner who made all these decisions. But as a result of these new partnership audit regulations, the IRS can now examine a partnership and assess tax to the partnership if there are more than 100 partners. And they're really getting after, you know, all these very large hedge funds and multi-tiered entities so that they can more quickly access the tax. It was so painful for the IRS to audit these partnerships that they just didn't.